But no one thinks, oh my God, terrible.
He's pretty great, but there's always, I don't know much of the Bible. So like when he spews in book one, he talks about, for at least like 3 pages, just strictly just naming people from the New Old Testament. I was lost. But I followed why, I think, but, and like why he mentioned Olympus. Now, like, that was confusing, why the gods are in there. Because this is before humankind was existent. And the Greek gods aren't supposed to exist for Milton, I thought, because he's not Greek. So why is Olympus being mentioned?
Okay, so do you remember why he lists them all?
Isn't it to join like Satan's army or something?
Yeah, but why does he give the Greek and Roman names? Is that a, I just don't know.
Maybe because that's, yes, that's what I was confused. They didn't know Greek and Romans existed at this point in the book.
Yeah, because they didn't exist.
Yeah.
Not only did they not know they existed, they didn't exist yet because this is, there are only 2 human beings who exist at the beginning of Paradise Lost. Namely,
Adam and Eve. But even when he's talking about those, he doesn't even, Adam and Eve don't exist yet. He's talking about like God's plotting to have these.
Possibly. It's not, there's a lot of argument about when Adam and Eve were created. But they hear that God, they heard before the fall. So do people want a very quick plot summary? Is this going to help you?
Yes.
Yeah. Tough. Okay. The very quick plot summary is we plunge in medias res. Do people know what that means? Yeah, so we plunge right into the middle of things, which is what James Bond movies do. Like every James Bond movie begins with the same pre-credit sequence, which is action is happening. We don't know what's going on, right? But then we quickly figure out, usually there's actually an exception to this in From Russia with Love, but we figure out who Bond is, even if it's the first new Bond. Like the first Daniel Craig James Bond or something like that, and he is going against someone we immediately decide is a bad guy, and there's danger and thrills and so on, and then we get to the end of that kind of opening episode, and then we get the credits, and then we get the story proper. So the idea of plunging right straight into the middle of things, that's literally what in medias res means, into the middle of things. The idea of plunging right into the middle of things goes back to ancient epic. It goes back to the Iliad, which begins in the middle of a war, and the Odyssey, which begins in the middle of several crises all at the same time. Then, later on, we get some background, and the background is given later. And in Paradise Lost, we're only reading the first 2 books, but in Paradise Lost, the background will be given later on when an angel tells Adam and Eve what the situation is, that these rebel angels rebelled against God, that they fought against God and his loyal angels and the Son of God, and that after fighting for 3 days, they lost. And when they lost, they were thrown, or they actually threw themselves out of heaven to avoid the horrible violence that they were now subject to. They were, I don't know, it's a little bit like maybe if a country annexed land from another country, and then the people in the other country just kind of went storming back. That's sort of what happens in heaven. So the rebel angels find themselves in hell where they are unconscious, where they are stunned into unconsciousness. And that is the situation in which Paradise Lost begins, is that they're stunned into unconsciousness, and then they start waking up. And so we find out what's going on in hell in the first 2 books of Paradise Lost, and we find the rebel angels are complaining about the injustice of what's happened to them. And then they take steps. And one thing that they remember is that there was a prophecy in heaven that God was going to create a new kind of creature. Do people know that the word creature means a created being? That is, the word creature, creatur, and create, they're related words. So it's not like, so if you've read Frankenstein, I think some of you have, right? I already asked this. How many people have read Frankenstein? So you know that frequently the monster is called the creature. And the idea is he's created by Victor Frankenstein. That's what makes him a creature. All creatures great and small, that biblical verse, which has become a title, it's all things created by God. So there's going to be another creature, namely us. And they had heard a rumor of this. And so what do they decide to do if you got to the end of book two?
I haven't got to the end, but they're going to corrupt. In the beginning, they start plotting.
Oh, in the beginning. Good one. Yeah, good.
Yeah, they're going to corrupt the, through the snake. I don't know if they even mentioned that, but like they're going to kind of mess around with this inferior being that's supposedly going to be created.
Yeah. And so what they're going to do is they're going to take, they're essentially using humans, you could say, as hostages. They're going to ruin what God's plan was. So they had heard about this. Then they are chained to this lake of fire. Then they escape from the lake of fire and they think about what to do. And they decide, or Satan himself decides, he'll come to earth and will corrupt human beings, and that will be a way of getting revenge on God. So what's happening off stage, Paradise Lost was originally, Milton thought that it could be a play before he turned it into an epic. So the very first drafts of Paradise Lost, there are a little bit of it survives, was going to be in the form of a kind of Shakespearean play in which Satan comes in and begins with a soliloquy. And that soliloquy actually appears in Paradise Lost, but not in the first two books. It's a later soliloquy of Satan's. But it was going to be a play in which Satan is going to take revenge. So off stage, while they are lying on the burning lake in hell, stuff is going on Earth, which is what makes it possible for Satan, once he gets out of hell and to the coasts of light, as he calls it, it's what makes it possible for him to come upon Adam and Eve in Eden. They have, in the meantime, been created. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask, so Beelzebub is not Satan, right?
No.
Okay, because that was
this
misconception I had going into this.
Yeah, Beelzebub is frequently Satan, as in Lord of the Flies, if you read that. Did you all still have to read that in high school?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So in Lord of the Beelzebub is the Lord of the Flies. That's a standard appellation for Beelzebub. But he isn't. But in Milton, there are a lot of demons, a lot of devils, but only one of them is Satan. So do people know what Satan means? It's an Aramaic word, so there's a reason that Satan is called Satan. Satan means the antagonist. So Satan has the name that he does because he is the antagonist of God. He is the enemy of God. He's the adversary. Maybe that's a better translation. He's the adversary of God. I'm not positive about this, but I believe he first appears in the Old Testament in the book of Job. And it's in the book of Job. Do people know the book of Job at all or what it's about?
Yeah. So
what is it?
It's this story from the Bible where Satan goes and talks to God. And he's like, oh, how do you know that? Because there's one man named Job who's like, loyal disciple of God, his follower, and saying, like, how do you know that he actually is loyal because he only has had a good life so far. And then God's like, oh, I guess we can test it then. And then he lets Satan go and, like, do these different things to Job and, like, take things away from him and, like, torture him to see if he, like, curses God or if he still is, like, loyal.
Yeah. So he is the way what Milton will call him is the accuser of mankind. That's Milton's phrase, that Satan is the accuser of mankind. And that's what he does in the book of Job, is he accuses human beings of not being good. And so he is kind of like in any... Perry Mason-like TV show, so the opposite of Law and Order, the TV shows where you're on the defense's side, not on the prosecution's side. In any such TV show, he would be the prosecutor. He would be the evil prosecutor who is trying to get the people we care about who have been accused of a crime. He's the one who's trying to convict them. And God is the judge and jury. And so that then gets... expanded into Satan being a torturer who just loves to hurt human beings. It's an expansion, but it's not his original appearance. So in the New Testament, he's the devil that we know, and this is how Milton is thinking of him. But then, as I said before, Milton makes the battle between God and Satan, or the revolution that Satan and his followers undertake, he makes that into something where Satan might in fact be the figure that we're rooting for. And that in fact what he's doing, this is called the satanic reading of Paradise Lost. The poet Percy Bysshe Shelley, who is married to Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein, called Satan, as I mentioned before, the hero of Paradise Lost. And that heroism for Shelley, also for William Blake, that heroism is the heroism of someone who stands up for principle against arbitrary power. Why should God be the king of everything? Why should his son be someone that everyone has to bow, bend their knees to, which is what God will say later in Paradise Lost. On this day I have begot whom I declare my only son, unto him all knees shall bow and shall declare him Lord. And Satan says, wait a second, where did that come from? And why are we worshiping each other anyhow? What's up with that? So Satan is an extremely, uses the rhetoric of democracy. Whether he's actually democratic or not is a different issue because, of course, he is the head of the rebel angels. But he uses the rhetoric of democracy. And just one other thing, again, this is all background. One other thing to know is that Milton was a revolutionary, that Milton was an important person in the English Revolution that started in 1642. Do people know about this? It eventually led to the French Revolution. So in 1642, King Charles I, we now have a third, but there's a reason that we only have three Charleses, that it's been so long before we got another Charles. In 1642, King Charles I was regarded as so tyrannical by those with a revolutionary spirit in England, Quakers among them. Essentially those who believed that religion should be a matter of individual conscience and not state-imposed, that eventually there was a revolution. It was Parliament was on the side of the people versus the king, whom they regarded as despotic. And so this revolution begins in 1642, And it ends in 1649, this is how the French Revolution comes out of it, when the king is put on trial by Parliament and convicted of tyranny and executed. So in 1649, Charles was executed, and for the next 11 years, England did not have a king and was originally run by Parliament, but then all sorts of other corruption crept in because power corrupts.
Cromwell?
Yes. So this is Oliver Cromwell, who is the essentially the head of Parliament, but then eventually he himself dismisses Parliament and makes himself the Lord Protector, which is when he becomes corrupted. It's arguable. But at any rate, Milton had the office under Cromwell. Milton, remember, was blind by now, but he had the office under Cromwell of what was called the Latin Secretary, which doesn't sound like, oh, great, a Latin secretary. But in fact, Latin was the diplomatic language of Europe. It is how, it's the way English is now, Latin was in 1649. So this was, in a way, the equivalent of being the foreign secretary. It was Milton who was the chief representative of England's interests in interacting with other European states who were really unhappy that a king had been executed because they were all run by kings. Same thing happens in the French Revolution 140 years later. The execution of Louis XVI and of Marie Antoinette and then of many, many other people made the rest of Europe really, really nervous. But they explicitly said that they were following what had happened in England 140 years earlier. So here in this poem, you have a king, namely God, and you have revolutionaries who are trying to overthrow this what they regard as the arbitrary authority of God, and they lose. Just as in 1660, Milton and the Puritan Revolution, as it was called, or sometimes called the Revolution of the Saints, the way they lost. And Milton was actually at risk of being executed for his part in the English Revolution. And he wasn't due to the intervention of some people who had friends on both sides, in particular the poet Andrew Marvell, but others. But then he essentially went into a kind of internal exile. He was no longer a figure in the government or a figure of any political power. And so what does he do with his time? He writes Paradise Lost. So Paradise Lost is a post revolutionary failure poem. And this is one reason to think that he's on the side of Satan, who is also a revolutionary who loses. And Milton never thought that he was wrong, that the English Revolution was wrong. He thought it was terrible that it was eventually failed. That it seemed to succeed, but that it eventually failed. So there's a lot of potential autobiography in the theme of Paradise Lost. And in a later book, again, not something we'll look at, but in a later invocation of the Muses, the way he begins Paradise Lost by invoking the heavenly muse, he talks about how he is, as he puts it, and I quoted this for you before because this is an example of chiasmus. Remember the crisscross, A, B, B, A? So this example of chiasmus I quoted for you before where he speaks of himself as, he says, though fallen on evil days, though fallen. That's how he describes himself. Though fallen on evil days, though fallen. And then he says, with darkness and with dangers compassed round and solitude. That's how he sees himself when he's writing Paradise Lost. Fallen on evil days, though fallen, with darkness and with dangers compassed round and solitude. So those are some of the reasons for seeing Paradise Lost as essentially pro-Satan. Now, pro-Satan doesn't mean pro-devils. Mammon, for example, or Beelzebub or Belial, they're not so sublime. They're not so admirable. The only really admirable figure among the fallen angels is Satan. But he's the only one who really matters. The others don't. So getting back to your question about the names of the Greek and Roman and Egyptian gods in Paradise Lost, what that gets introduced. So how many people have read the Iliad at some point? Okay, why don't you also read that for, like, Thursday?
Yes.
Okay, good. One convention in epic literature, it's the most boring convention in epic literature, is what's called a catalog. So because epics are essentially claiming to be about everything, that is one of the sort of ideological ideas behind an epic. It's why creation stories are often told in epics. It's about everything. So one idea behind an epic, then, if it's about everything, is that it's going to mention a huge number of things. Just mention them, but a huge number of things just to show the extent of the world that it touches upon. So in the Iliad, there is something known as the Catalog of Ships, where Homer gives a list that goes on and on and on of every ship and who is sailing it and where it's from. Every ship that has come to the shores of Troy, or of the plain that Troy is on, in order to fight against the Trojans in the Trojan War. And Homer himself says, I couldn't possibly remember this without the aid of the muse. There are just so many. And it's just a list. Now, that's actually unfair to Homer because it's more than just a list, but most people reading the Iliad the first time, that is the place where they, if you really are having trouble sleeping, pulling out the catalog of ships and reading it will help you a lot. And so Milton is doing that with the Catalog of Fallen Angels. And what he says is, he says, who are these fallen angels? What are their names? And then he says, in heaven, they've become non-angels. In heaven, their names have been extirpated, have been rubbed out of the books of life in heaven. So they were nameless at the time of their fall, because their names have been raised and blotted out, he says. And then he says, and this is finally the answer to your question, nor had they yet among the sons of Eve got themselves new names. But he says, I'm going to have to use those new names. So the sons of Eve, by the way, how many of you have read, like, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, C.S. Lewis? Seen the movie?
Yeah,
not that great a movie. Know about it?
Yes.
Okay, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there's some kids, it's World War II, so they're sent out of London to a kindly professor's house, because professors are always kindly, right? you laugh. F. And see, now that'll teach you to think professors aren't kindly. Now you know the truth. Sent to a kindly professor's house, and he's got a wardrobe, which is a closet. And one of the kids is just bored, and she's kind of playing hide and seek, and she goes into the wardrobe, and a new world. And there's a lion there named Aslan, and there's a white witch who's actually, you may or may not know, is Adolf Hitler. And are you surprised by that, Iwanish? Yeah, no, the white witch is Hitler. And all sorts of things happen there. But the females in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe are called Daughters of Eve, and the males are called Sons of Adam. So that phrase comes from Paradise Lost. C.S. Lewis actually wrote a book called A Preface to Paradise Lost, which thinks, and Lewis makes the claim that Satan is not the hero of Paradise Lost. He's very much against that idea. But he's arguing against it because he feels it needs arguing against. Yeah.
Is there a good, for example, Beowulf has Tolkien did a famous narrative. Is there any famous author that has done a narrative on the entirety of Paradise Lost?
You mean turned it into a novel?
No, in this margin is a bunch of footnotes, and they're Beowulf has one that Tolkien did.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The literary.
Yeah, there are millions of footnotes to Paradise Lost. There's footnotes to every word if you really want it. But a cool addition to Paradise Lost, not that many notes, but it's very cool that he did this, nevertheless, is Philip Pullman. So do people know who he is? Oh, dear. Well, this is actually great because now you get to read Philip Pullman and you'll be blown away. But you may have seen the not-so-good HBO adaptation of The Golden Compass. Mm-hmm. Familiar to anyone? A little bit? Okay. But not to everyone. Okay, the sixth and final volume of the double trilogy that he wrote is, I hope, coming out soon. But Philip Pullman wrote, starting in the 90s, a trilogy called His Dark Materials.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, of which The Golden Compass, the three volumes of it are The Golden Compass, The Subtle Knife, and The Amber Spyglass. And it is just totally great. It's YA literature, and it is fantastically great, and it is better than Tolkien. I'll just put it that way. Stephen Colbert would never forgive me, but it's better than Tolkien. It's just fantastically amazing. I haven't done this for years, but I used to teach a course here called Adolescent Literature. I sometimes do it over the summer, and that tends to be people's favorite work is when we do His Dark Materials. It's a retelling of Paradise Lost, but he also, but not in anything like Paradise Lost. You wouldn't know it was a retelling of Paradise Lost unless someone like me said it was. Essentially, he's very much on Satan's side, and Lord Asriel is the satanic figure. Played by, anyone know? Daniel Craig.
Oh,
now we're talking. Now we're interested. But look, give His Dark Materials a look. Just give it a look. It's really amazing. So Pullman did an addition to Paradise Lost. So that's why I mention it. Also, His Dark Materials, the name of the whole trilogy, is a phrase from Paradise Lost. Satan looks into the abyss, which is all chaos, and it is a chaos which are perhaps gods, that is His Dark Materials. It's a huge eternal chaos where God hasn't done anything yet, but what we're seeing are perhaps His Dark Materials to create new worlds. So that's where Pullman is getting the title of the whole trilogy from. So that's a cool version with cool footnotes. Christopher Ricks's footnotes, I think, are Christopher Ricks is a really brilliant and wonderful critic, and his footnotes are helpful without being overwhelming. But at any rate, the fallen angels have not yet among the sons of Eve got themselves new names, but I, Milton, am going to tell you what they're going to be called later in the history of humanity. And what they're going to be called later are all the gods that people worshipped before Abraham returned, at least some people, to the Abrahamic religions of monotheism. So everyone know what the Abrahamic religions are, what that refers to? What, Massimo, what does it refer to? Sorry?
I think I do.
Okay.
Christianity, Judaism, and Islam.
Right? Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the religions that descend from Abraham, Christianity and Judaism through Isaac, and Islam through?
Ishmael.
Through Ishmael. And those religions share the idea of monotheism. That is, that there is one, sometimes called hidden God. That's a phrase from Isaiah. There is a hidden God, a God that we can't see, but a God who is the ruler of everything. And this is opposed to the local deities and the idolatry of local deities that you get in the standard religions or the older religions of that region of the world. And in particular, Greek, Roman, Egyptian, all the gods and goddesses in Greek, Roman, and Egyptian religion are fallen angels, devils to adore as deities, as the narrator of Paradise Lost puts it. So when you see all their names, what you are seeing are the names that you're familiar with from Percy Jackson and from mythology. And what Milton is saying is that these are the rebels who tried to take over from God, and who then, in order to corrupt us human beings, this is the official line that I'm now giving you about Paradise Lost's official claim, is that those who worshiped them were in fact devil worshipers. And they didn't know it. They were fooled. We were fooled into thinking that these were the creators of the world. They weren't. We were fooled. But they were the fallen angels. And now Milton gives you a catalog of who they are. And now we have names for the fallen angels. And they're not the names that they actually had, if this were a true story. But they are names that they will get, and that we, reading Paradise Lost, we writing Paradise Lost, can keep track of them. Yeah.
Is this
This is Milton going on the side.
Okay.
So one of the things he says, I was actually planning for us to do a little bit more about meter today, and there's some stuff that I do want to say, but one of the things that he says at the very start of Paradise Lost, do people have it with them? Okay, so someone, it's okay, we can do this orally. Someone should read just the first 22 lines aloud. Someone who has it.
Sure, I can do it.
Okay, go for it. Start.
Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe, with loss of Eden, till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat, sing heavenly muse, that on the secret top of Oreb or of Sinai, didst inspire that shepherd who first taught the chosen seed in the beginning how the heavens and earth rose out of chaos. Or if Sion Hill delight thee more, and Silo's brook that flowed fast by the oracle of God, I thence invoke thy aid to my adventurous song that with no middle flight intends to soar above the Aeonian mount while it pursues things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme.
Okay, so stop there, actually. Great, thank you. So the Aeonian mount, do you have a note on that? Oh, don't worry, you don't have to find it. The Aeonian Mount is where the Muses lived. And so when he says he's going to soar above that, that's the first moment where he's saying he's going to do something which is not entangled in the Greek and Roman and Egyptian mythology that mistakenly believes that they're that those they worship are gods when in fact they're devils. So the opening of Paradise Lost, those first 22 lines, I know you just read about 16 or so, those first 22 lines are the official view of Paradise Lost. That is, he is going to fly with no middle flight above the very haunt of the Muses. And then he says, while it pursues things unattempted yet, in prose or rhyme. The word attempted is a word that you may notice as you read the poem. One of the things that Satan says is that God tempted our attempt and wrought our fall. So an interesting kind of pun there. Tempted our attempt. That is their attempt to win the rulership of heaven. So Milton is also attempting something. He's attempting something unattempted yet in prose or rhyme. Now we remember, of course, that Paradise Lost does not rhyme. So by the word rhyme, he both means rhyming poems. So I'm going to do something which is revolutionary. In this poem about revolutions, I'm going to do something revolutionary by doing something that rhyme has never attempted. And you could say, yeah, he just means blank verse. But he much more means poetry. Rhyme there is what's called a metonymy for poetry. It's like calling the king the crown. Like, well, the crown looks with very great anxiety at what is being asked of it, or something like that. Or if you talk about a British case, it's the crown versus Mortimer Schnurd. Or if you say, we have 10 sails under our command, that's a metonymy for 10 ships. Or if you say, all hands on deck, you shouldn't just get a picture of a bunch of little hands on deck. It means its hand stands for the whole human being. So rhyme there is a metonymy for poetry. And he says, I am going to try to write a poem which has never been attempted in the history of poetry. So that's why he was known as Mr. Modest, not. I'm going to write a poem never before attempted in the very history of poetry. So things unattempted yet in rhyme, but things unattempted yet in prose. What does he mean by prose?
Like just normal writing.
Normal writing, but what is the greatest, most, or maybe most influential, most prominent work of prose in Western history? The Bible. So he is saying, this poem is going to try to outgo Homer and Virgil. That's the rhyme. I'm writing an epic. I'm going to try to do things that Homer and Virgil did not attempt to do, And I'm also going to try to do things that the Bible did not attempt to do. Okay, what? Finish reading that opening part?
Yeah. And chiefly thou, O Spirit, that dost prefer before all temples the upright heart and pure, instruct me, for thou knowest. Thou from the first wast present, and with mighty wings outspread, dove-like, sat brooding on the vast abyss, and madest it. It pregnant.
Okay, stop there for a second. So listen to that image. So he calls upon the muse, that spirit that was present from the first, and like a dove, dove-like, satsed, that's just second person singular. Does everyone know that? That if you say thou satsed, or thou wast, or thou art, and people who are trying to sound like they are trying to sound Shakespearean will say something like, he wast there. It's the kind of thing you used to get on Car Talk. Or he satsed there. And that's wrong. Satsed is second person singular. Thou satsed, thou wast, thou art, thou readest this book. So he's talking to the Holy Spirit and he says, and chiefly thou, O Spirit, that from the first wast pregnant and dove-like, like a dove, satst brooding. Sorry, did I just... Was present. Did I say present?
The wast present.
Yes. Yeah. And dove-like satst brooding o'er the vast abyss and madest it pregnant. So do people know what the word brooding means besides... You know, being an angsty adolescent.
Like brooding is kind of like overwhelming. You're like sad. It's like overseeing, like something sitting and looking down, brooding over.
Okay, yeah. So if you're brooding over something, it's just on your mind and you just won't let it go. But that's actually a metaphor for what brooding literally means. Yeah.
It's like reproducing.
Reproducing how? Not so much. Eggs. Yeah, you brood over eggs. So the reason people are said to brood is it's like they're sitting on an egg and not moving, and all their attention is on this one thing. So among birds, which sex of birds broods usually?
Chicken.
Chicken. Interesting sex. My pronoun is chicken. The female, yeah. It's not always true. There's some birds where the males brood, but generally it's the female that broods. Milton thought, apparently this may not be true, but Milton thought that it was female doves that brooded. So when he says, thou dove-like sat'st brooding o'er the vast abyss, he is treating the Holy Spirit, the muse, chiefly thou, O Spirit, treating the Holy Spirit, or the muse, as female, that dove-like sat's brooding o'er the vast abyss, but brooding over an abyss, not an egg, an abyss. And then what did that female dove-like Holy Spirit, everyone knows that the dove is a symbol of the Holy Spirit, right?
Yeah.
Is this familiar to people? Noah's Ark is, that's a back formation. When Genesis was written, it wasn't, oh, a dove, that must be the Holy Spirit. That comes much later. The dove is the Holy Spirit because of the, it's the dove who appears when Gabriel tells Mary that she is going to be pregnant. So the dove stands for the Holy Spirit. That's why dove-like sat's brooding o'er the vast abyss. And madest it pregnant. So that would make the Holy Spirit male. So it's simultaneously male and female. That dove-like sat brooding o'er the vast abyss. And madest it pregnant. Brood first, make it pregnant after. And the idea that the Holy Spirit is binary... it's going to turn out, we won't get to this either, but there's a really wonderful moment where, do you have a note on that? Or?
Well, yeah, I mean, and we're going to get to book one, because for spirits, when they please, can either sex assume.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I know it's not talking about the Holy Spirit, but it's still.
No, that's absolutely right. And later, that's great. And later on, Adam, one thing, Paradise Lost is full of heresies. A lot of it could have gotten Milton burnt at the stake if people had been more careful readers. Or he actually published a book about his own theology, what he thought was true about theology. And he didn't publish it. He wrote it, but it wasn't published till 150 years after his death. Because had it been published, he would be in serious, serious trouble. He would have been in serious, serious trouble. But Paradise Lost is consistent with what he says in this book, which is called Of Christian Doctrine. And one thing he says in Of Christian Doctrine is no human being has ever seen God. So news to Moses, news to Abraham, news to lots of people. But Milton was sure of that. One of the things he says later in Paradise Lost, or one of his minor heresies, is that he says Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, before the fall, of course they're having sex. You can't have a loving relationship with your partner and have that love fire on all cylinders without having sex. So the standard reading of the story of Genesis is there are these two innocents, and then one day a phallic symbol shows up and says, I got something delicious for you, lady. And she says, okay. And then God says, how did you know you were naked? And it's because this delicious thing offered by the phallic symbol was something that they both partook of. So the phallic symbol, otherwise known as the serpent, Adam and Eve discover sexuality, and a standard reading of Genesis is that it's a story of what all of us do in our own lives. We start out as innocent little children, we don't know about sex, and then we hit adolescence, and the completely mischief-making fact of erotic life comes into our lives and messes everything up. And when that comes into our lives, that's when we first feel real guilt. And so that's a standard view of Genesis read allegorically. And everything falls into place. You know, myths are often about psychological. You know, just think of most myths that you know. Think of Pandora's Box, whatever. Myths are narratives in which human psychology is externalized. And it's really easy to see the myth of the Garden of Eden as about the awakening of sexuality, which is why Adam and Eve are embarrassed to be naked. And they didn't know they were naked the way little kids don't know they're naked before that. But Milton says, wrong. He says that, in fact, Adam and Eve, of course they were having sex in the Garden of Eden because they loved each other. And that was an expression of their love for each other. And it was hippie-like sex. That is, no guilt, no sense of dirtiness, none of the stuff that makes sex both fun and scary. But it was really intense nevertheless, because all of their souls were poured into it. So before the fall, this is again later on in Paradise Lost, before Eve eats the apple, which she doesn't do in Paradise Lost for sexual reasons in any way. The temptation that Satan offers her for eating the apple is that he tells her very convincingly that the prohibition against eating the apple must be God testing her to see whether she's just going to be an obedient and dependent figure, or whether she's going to use her own reason as against these apparent restrictions that God actually wants her to think her way past. And again, to give you, this is, as I say, this is all context for the first two books, so it's not stuff we're going to get to in our reading of Paradise Lost, but to give you a sense of this, God does do that to Adam. He says to Adam, Adam says, it's great that I could name all these animals and I can do all these things, but I feel kind of lonely. All these animals, they have company. In particular, they have erotic company. I can see them. And they're all happy because they have their own mirror images. But me, I'm all alone. And God says to Adam, I'm all alone. Do I look unhappy? And Adam's response to that is, no, but, you know, you're God, and I'm not. So I would really like it if I had company. And God says, good job. Not good job, but good job. I was testing you to see what you would say when I said you should be perfectly content to be alone. And you said the right thing. So go to sleep. Here's this little rib. Turn it into Eve. And now you guys are the OTP. And that moment where Adam is tested, Satan says to Eve, not quite, but pretty implicitly, remember how God tested Adam? And remember that God respects you just as much as Adam? What do you think he's doing here when he says, don't eat this apple? As though it matters in the slightest whether you eat this apple or not. Milton uses the word apple. As though it matters in the slightest. What do you think God's doing here? And Eve says, don't. Milton invented that word. Don't. No. So Eve eats the apple. And has nothing to do with sex. What it has to do with is intellectual freedom. Why would God prevent us from something that is obviously so unimportant unless it were a test? Which, of course, it is. She's right about that. Satan is right about that. But passing the test means being slavishly obedient to God. Whereas Eve quite reasonably thought that if God were a good God, passing the test would mean taking the initiative, standing up to what God says she should just suck up to. Stand up, don't suck up, is what Eve does. So, but going back then to the fact that they are having sex before the fall, Milton does not see the fall of Adam and Eve as occurring, as having anything to do with sexuality. Before the fall, Adam is talking to an angel, Raphael, who tells Adam about the war in heaven. That is, this is where we get the flashback to what happened before their creation. And Adam says, that's really interesting. Raphael says, and this is what it's like to be an angel. This is all the stuff that we do. And one day you may be angels too. If you obey God and it's all really good and you can come to heaven like us, and that'll be really great. And Adam says, wow, that sounds amazing. But there's one little thing that I'm worried about, which is there's this really fun thing Eve and I do. It's like great. It's like the greatest thing there is. What about you all up in heaven? And then, anyone know what happens? Raphael blushes. And he says, look, I really can't tell you too much about this. I'm not supposed to. But angels are kind of a lot more gaseous than solid. It's like, you human beings, you're like solid. But angels, they go right through the table. And just imagine what it must be like if the surfaces of our bodies don't prevent complete interpenetration. So he basically says, human beings, you get a little bit of penetration, but not that much, really, if you think about it, compared to what we can do. So enough said, he says. That's all I just want to say that. You shouldn't worry about it. When you make it to heaven, you're not going to think, oh, I really miss sex, because it's there, and it's even better. But the point is, even though we never meet an angel who is gendered female in Paradise Lost, that line that you're quoting, basically its angels are all non-binary in Paradise Lost. And they can have sex with each other. And it is literally deeper than the sex that humans can have with each other. So that's what Raphael says blushingly. So you get that at the very start. That dove-like sat brooding o'er the vast abyss and made it pregnant. That is, the Holy Spirit is non-binary. The first of many, many heresies in Milton. Okay, pick up from there. Oh, I'm sorry. And now Milton is doing things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme, which is to say that he is claiming in this poem that he's going to write a better epic than Homer or Virgil ever wrote, and a better account of the biblical story than, what's his name, God wrote. That is the claim that he's making. A claim that you might want to use the adjective satanic for. Okay, keep reading.
What in me is dark, illumined? What is low, raised, support? That to the height of this great argument, I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men.
Okay, so we talked about that line before, justify the ways of God to men, which is how Milton writes it. It gets remembered and picked up. Remember I quoted you Cummings and I quoted you A.E. Housman. Malt does more than ever Milton can to justify the ways of God to man. And Cummings has those lines, when any mortal, even the most odd, can justify the ways of man to God, I'll think it strange that any normal mortal cannot justify the ways of God to man. But Milton says justify the ways of God to men. Okay, so what he's saying is that in his poem, what he's trying to do is justify the ways of God to men. That is the point of the poem. My ambition is to justify the ways of God to men. If you were writing it as a paper for an undergraduate course, he would be saying, in this paper, I will justify the ways of God to men. And that's what he's saying at the end of what's called the invocation to book one, because it's the invocation of the muse. Okay, justify the ways of God to men. Someone paraphrase that. Yeah, go for it.
Justify the evil that we see in this world as not that being detrimental to the power of God.
Okay, so What's interesting is in that paraphrase, you left out the prepositional phrase, to men.
But he means mankind here, right? Not just men.
Okay, fine, mankind.
Okay.
So, paraphrase again, or someone else do it. Paraphrase again. Milton says, I'm trying to assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men. So just paraphrase that last part. What I mean to do is justify the ways of God to men. Yeah.
Explain to people why in like a world of God they're suffering.
Okay, so you're actually putting, if you think about it, you're using the two men. You're putting it in two different places in your paraphrase. Explain to people why they're suffering. Which is to say, justify to men the ways of God to men. Right? Do people say that? It's justify to men the ways of God to men. But he only uses the phrase once. So the question is really, is it justify to men the ways of God, or justify the ways of God to men? It's where the parentheses go, if this were math. So he's trying to justify something. That is the verb. And there's a direct object, which is a phrase. It's a phrasal direct object. The direct object is literally the ways, but it's the ways, but it's really a phrase that you need for the direct object. So he's going to justify either the ways of God. Who's he going to justify them to? Who's going to be the jury?
Men.
Or he's going to justify the ways of God to men, in which case, who's the jury?
You want to say God, but I don't see how that can make grammatical sense. Like,
yeah, it would have to be an implicit jury.
Yeah.
So in one case, the jury's explicit. Justify the ways of God, and who's going to be the jury as to whether he succeeds in justifying the ways of God? Humans are. The other possibility is he's not justifying all of God's ways, and in particular, he's not justifying God's ways to the fallen angels. He's justifying what matters to us, which is the ways of God to men. Yes, it's true my client may have robbed a bank, but he's not on trial for bank robbery. He's on trial for the way he treated his roommate. So all I have to do is justify the way he treated his roommate. Yeah, he may have robbed a bank, but people of the jury, that's not what you're called upon here to decide. So, or it could be, my client is said to be a bad person, but I still think he should get into Brandeis. So I am going to justify all his ways, everything that he's done. I'm going to prove it's okay. And to you, the admissions committee, I'm going to justify his ways to you. So it's not the way he treated the admissions committee that's being justified. It's the admissions committee is sitting in judgment on all the stuff that he did before he applied to Brandeis. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah, so like either ways specific to mankind or all the ways God has ever acted to everything.
Yeah.
To men, so I see. Like justify all his actions to men or justify the actions he's done to them.
Right, so justify what he's done to us or justify to us everything that he's ever done. Okay, so justify to us everything that he's ever done makes us judges of God, which is what Adam and Eve are doing when they eat the fruit. It's what Satan does when he says what God has done is wrong, except Satan isn't a man, so that may not quite be relevant, but it could be relevant. The other possibility is justify the way he's treated us. But then who's he justifying it for? He's justifying it for, you could say, any rational being. Any rational being, angels, Platonic philosophers, the Son of God, God himself, the way he's treated us, we can justify. I can justify. So it's not clear which of the two he means. But here's an important point, which is that if you're justifying the ways of God, what that means is that a standard, it's not a view we much hold, but it is a view a lot of people held at the time, is that there's a standard definition of goodness, which is that it's whatever God says it is. Has anyone seen, you should look at this on Comedy Central, you can find it on YouTube, I think, or just Google it. There's a series of fun sketches called Mr. Deity, in which God is essentially deciding how to create the universe, and he's got an assistant, and God says, I'm thinking of making it possible for people to kill each other just by thinking nasty things about each other. And his assistant says, I don't think that's a good idea. And God says, huh. Yeah, maybe that's a little bit bloody. Okay, I won't do that. How about childhood terminal diseases? And this guy says, yeah, I don't think people like that either. And he says, nah, I'm going to keep it in. I'll do it. So, Mr. Deity basically creates the world that we live in these sketches. But one definition of goodness, and this is, do people know why Pharaoh wasn't persuaded by the 10 plagues to let the children of Israel go? Do you know the story? So children of Israel want to go. Pharaoh says, no, I need you to be my slaves. Moses says, terrible things are going to happen. And he calls down a plague and everyone gets COVID-19. And Pharaoh says, okay, go. And then they recover and he says, nah, stop. And then he says, all right, plague number two, everyone gets monkeypox. So I'm updating this a little bit. I don't know if you realize. And Pharaoh says, enough, enough, go, go, go. But then the plague is over and Pharaoh decides not to. Do you know what the line is in the book of Exodus where Pharaoh changes his mind? The same line appears over and over again. So the line is, and God hardened Pharaoh's heart. So people are kind of freaked out by that. Because Pharaoh keeps saying go, and then God says, no, I'm gonna change his mind without his even knowing it. I'm gonna harden his heart, and he wants to let them go, but I'm going to reprogram him so he doesn't. And he does this 10 times. And then finally Pharaoh drowns in the Red Sea. So a lot of people are saying, wait a second, it doesn't really seem fair that God, who could reprogram Pharaoh, programmed him so that he wants to do the right thing, and God keeps preventing him from doing the right thing. So this is an issue for people, if you think about it. How would you deal with that issue? What if someone said it's not fair of God, what he does to Pharaoh? It's not Pharaoh of God, huh? What's your response?
He's testing him.
How's he testing him? He hardens his heart. He keeps passing the test, and God says, you got too many right. I'm going to change the right answers. God says, is eight even or odd? And Pharaoh says, it's even. And God says, oh, shoot. No, I'm going to make eight an odd number from now on. Or Pharaoh says, it's even. God says, Ooh, tweak. And then says to Pharaoh, okay, so what did you say it was? And Pharaoh said, I said it was odd. But it was God who did that to him. Yeah.
I think testing could be correct, but not Pharaoh. Maybe the children of Israel would be like, oh, well, if they get off so easily, will they really believe it was me? Well, let's see if they can, like, withstand.
Yeah, so from the point of view of the children of Israel, you know, whatever, it's a good lesson. But Pharaoh is being treated really badly. Yeah.
You'd say, like, well, what is fair? Like, you're saying fair by our standards, but what's fair by God's standards?
Exactly. So we do, so this is actually what Martin Luther said, is we don't understand how that could possibly be fair, what God does to Pharaoh. It seems totally wrong. And for this reason, we should be ashamed of ourselves for thinking that we know better than God what's good and what's evil. If God does it, it's good. It's what President Nixon said. When the president does it, that means it's not illegal. If God does it, it's okay. If Trump takes files, they're declassified. All he has to do is think of them as declassified, they're declassified. So that is a standard view, that if God does it, it's okay. And so what that does is it says the definition of good or of justice is whatever God does. Anything God does is therefore just. It is God's doing it causes it to be just. Because there is no justice without God, and God gets to define what's just. It's not that we assume God is just, he does some things that look really weird, and we have to think about how to think about them to see that they are just. So a standard version of that is, if God's so good, why is there evil in the world? And your version would be something like, because it's good that there's evil in the world, because God did that. So tough. No problem. But there's another standard answer to why there's evil in the world that doesn't say because God did it. It's not a because. Did your parents say because I said so when you were little kids? Yeah. So it's not a because I said so moment. There's a way of claiming that the fact of evil is actually good. Yeah.
Is that like good is only good if it's a choice?
Yes, only if it's free will. Exactly. So the reason that there's evil in the world is because it's a result of free will. Because people get to choose, and having a world with free will is better than having a world without free will. Okay, so notice, you know that Calvin and Luther believed in what's called double predestination, which is at the moment that you're born, nothing that you can do can make any difference. You're either going to heaven or hell. So that's predestination, right? And you can spend all your life giving money to charity and working as a doctor without frontiers and just helping people and helping the poor and helping those wounded in war and fighting against war. And your friend can spend all her time drinking and doing drugs and robbing banks for her habit, but if she's predestined to go to heaven, she's going to heaven. And if you're predestined to go into hell, you're going to hell. Nothing you can do about it. Is that good? Yeah, because God said so. The free will version is, here's why it's good that there's evil in the world. It's not because God said so. It's because we all agree that free will is better than no free will. But it comes at a cost. And the cost is that people will do bad things. That's why gun control is bad. People should have the freedom to shoot up schools. Comes at a cost. Freedom is never free. Not my view, by the way, but that is a similar argument that's made by the libertarian right. Okay, Milton says, I'm coming to justify the ways of God to men. He could do it in one line. If he believed the because I said so idea. God's ways are just because he's God, thus just. How's that? Iambic pentameter. That's all he would need. Think how much shorter Paradise Lost would be. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying either, but in a sense, they come to the same thing. He's saying either the way God treats us can be justified to any rational being in the universe, no matter who they are, including Satan, which is the way he treats us, I'm going to show that you can't complain. That if you have a decent conception of justice, then here is this almighty character who behaves in conformity to your pre-existent idea of justice. So God is a moral being, not automatically, but because he does what we would consider to be moral even if we didn't know there was a God. So the two things Milton might say is the way God treats human beings, that's moral. I don't have to worry about the way he treats the rebel angels. And in fact, I don't know whether that was moral, but I can say I can justify the ways of God to men. I can justify the ways God treats human beings. Or he might be saying, everything God does is morals, and who is in a position, who has enough insight to be able to understand that? Human beings. What it means to be human is to be able to sit on a jury in which you decide whether God is moral or not. And I claim in this poem that I can show that he is moral. But that means that Milton thinks human beings have an idea of morality which is separate from their idea of worship. It's not worship God, he is therefore moral. It might be worship God because he's moral, but those are different. And just to show you how this pans out, in Milton's last poem, a poem based on the story of Samson, there is a character who says, perhaps to clarify the moment in Paradise Lost, just are the ways of God and justifiable to men. So all of God's ways are just, is what Milton says in this later poem. And humans have enough intelligence and insight and ability to judge that those ways, that we can see that they're just. But the crucial, first, really important thing that Milton is saying is God does not define goodness. God does not define justice. Justice is an independent concept that God will either live up to or not live up to. I'm going to try to claim he does do it. But then Satan in Paradise Lost says, wow, God, that sure was unjust, the way he treated us. So the question, is God just or not? Suddenly it's God who's on trial in Paradise Lost. The way he was put on trial in concentration camps, do people know that? That there's actually a recent movie about this.
Yeah, I saw a little bit of it.
Like, yeah.
The ending is, I saw that part.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see why he might be put on trial under those conditions. Milton is doing the same thing. I forget the name, but Milton is doing the same thing. Okay, so we weren't going to do any Paradise Lost today, but we started. So now I had other things in mind, including Pope.
Poe, you said, or Pope?
Sorry?
Did you say Pope?
Pope. Pope.
Like Alexander Pope.
Like Alexander Pope. So bring that in on Thursday. We'll talk about Paradise Lost probably for another couple of days. Okay. If you're fasting, have an easy fast. But I assume if you're fasting, you're not here right now. So, okay. See you guys on Thursday.